Rabbi Eliph is really a very special person and has great insight. And so we are very honored that he is here tonight to talk about the miracle of 67, the Six-Day War, Chicago, and religious Zionism. And without any further ado, I introduce Rabbi Dr. Zev Eliph.
Thank you, Rabbi Eisenberg. The trick to receiving a successful introduction is making sure that you pay your member dues, which I did. The trick to being a historian, however, there are only two tricks to being a historian. Number one, you have to have a thesis that's provable. And number two, you need a really good straw man. You need a fall guy, somebody who is going to set up the arc for the balance of the book, article, or lecture, whatever it is, the intellectual task, the enterprise calls for a good straw man. And so, if those of us who are familiar with the Hebrew Theological College on the second floor know that there are several pictures of various leaders over time. I believe there are five, if I'm correct. The one all the way to the left, of course, is Rabbi Eisenberg, claims that he works for me. I believe he is the ranking HDC official as Chancellor Emeritus, not I. And next to he is Rabbi Don Well. And beyond that is, who's the previous?
Rabbi Rosenbaum.
And before Rabbi Rosenbaum was president of Hebrew Theological College, he was rabbi of the Loop Synagogue. And if you didn't daven downtown, you knew him best from the pages of the Sentinel. The Sentinel's a fabulous resource for the study of Judaism in Chicago. And I want to begin not with source one, but with two editorials. Rabbi at Random was the name of his weekly column. And he was so dedicated, so committed to ensuring that Chicago Jewry receive his sagacious advice, his wisdom. He did it even when he wasn't even in Chicago. So, take a look. June 8th, 1967. Very significant week for world Jewry at this time. This column is generally written some 10 days before it is likely published. Everybody see where I am? That is why, while like so many of you, I think of little else but the Israeli crisis during every free moment, I have not commented on it in print. I don't know what to say. Events have an uncanny way of belying predictions. And I am mindful of the Talmudic adage that in these post-temple times, such prophecy has become the domain of fools. So I cannot know whether peace or war, victory or defeat will prevail when this is read. Truly, only a fool would attempt such predictions. And he goes on. Of course, by June 8th, world Jewry knew that Nasser's forces had been dismantled and that the Six-Day War was coming to a close. Flip to the next Rabbi Rosenbaum editorial. As it happened, now we're in June 15th, Rabbi Rosenbaum, who admits that he writes it a week in advance, is aware of the sensational, miraculous conclusion to the 67 war. As it happened, I was in New York City on the day of the outbreak of hostilities between Israel and the Arab states. I was accordingly able to observe at first hand the reactions in this, the world's largest Jewish city, during the tense hours and days from June 5th and on. I have no doubt but that Chicago's Jewish citizens were as deeply moved and affected as were their brothers in New York. But I doubt very much whether the same pervasive feeling of total involvement was as palpable on State Street and Michigan Avenue, or even on the corner of California and Devon, as it was on 5th Avenue and 42nd Street, or 7th Avenue and 34th Street. There's probably a Nick game going on there. Or on almost any thoroughfare in Brooklyn or in Queens. I don't get it. I'm going to write this to Chicago's Jews. But what is Rabbi Rosenbaum's supposition? That what he witnessed in Manhattan, the grave concern for the ramifications of the war in the Middle East, was taken with such sincerity, with such import, with such checkbooks, that's the implication if you read on, that Chicago Jewry could stand to learn something, or maybe they simply could not. Maybe, quite plainly, Chicago Jews were the second city, the second community to New York, to New York's Jews. So here's my straw man. And it isn't so. Source one. The Chicago Tribune reported on June 8th. Please also, I should have said at the outset, I invite people to wax autobiographical. If you were at Camp Mosheva in 67, tell us. There's going to be opportunity, I hope, to have a real discussion. These aren't the only primary sources in the room. Thank goodness there are many primary sources, I'm sure, in this shul. Is it a shul still? Right now. Chicago Tribune, source one. Contributions in the sales of bonds to aid Israel have exceeded $7.5 million. Always very deceptive. Always learned from my great mentor, Professor Jonathan Sarna, that when you quote numbers, when you quote figures, they mean nothing unless you recalculate for inflation. On the internet, it's quite easy. Just find a website, westegg.com, and you plug it in. So what is $7.5 million over a three-day period equivalent to in today's dollars? $54 million. That's not bad. In Chicago, Jewish officials said yesterday, the total represents 3 days of campaigns that were hastily organized. Nobody anticipated this. When war broke out in the Middle East and the Israeli government appealed to Jews of the world for financial aid. It's a very important point. Were Israeli Jewry's reliance on the exile, on world Jewry, on American Jewry most particularly, I want to explore that idea as we move on. We have sold, in the quotations in the third paragraph, $4.5 million, again, equivalent to $32 million, in bonds, and the pledges are coming in so fast. We cannot keep pace with them, said David Zeisman. I always presume, speaking to a crowd of Jews in Chicago, that somebody's related. It's everybody that I mentioned. Somebody I know down knows this person. Chairman of the Bonds of Israel office in Chicago. We are running about 500,000 behind in the tabulations. There appears to be no slackening in the paces. Quite satisfied with the financial contributions of Chicago Jews. So in fact, one imagines that had Rabbi Rosenbaum not been in New York, I don't know why he was in Manhattan at the time, had he not been, he too would have been greatly impressed by the outpouring of support, spiritual, psychological, financial, material support to the war effort in Israel. There's no question. There's absolutely no doubt about it that Chicago's Jewish community has always seen as its mission Zionism. Hebrew Theological College, the founders were always very, very involved. In fact, in 1935, in the Daily Courier, the leading Yiddish weekly at the time, it's a little bit unclear. The first long-term president of Hebrew Theological College, Rabbi Saul Silver, writes a eulogy for none other than Rav Kook in a volume dedicated to Rabbi Silver. Rav Kook writes a letter congratulating on 20 years of service in the Chicago Jewish community. There was always great support in the Chicago, and more importantly for our purposes, the Orthodox community in Chicago has always offered its support and always embraced a Zionist, a religious Zionist mission. The Six-Day War challenges the relationship between world Jewry, meaning the Jews outside in the Golat, in the exile in North America, and its relationship to Israel, perhaps more than any other event in the 20th or even the 19th century. The Six-Day War challenged the existing relationship. What might I mean by that? What was the impact of the Six-Day War on the relationship between American Judaism and Israeli Judaism? Any ideas? Yes.
Prior to 1967, Israel was that Jewish state. It was a state where I could go visit. And after 1967, Israel proved that it's not just an experiment. It stepped out of the laboratory, and Jews suddenly found themselves having to decide, is this really the place for Jews and more than an experiment?
There's no question that the footing that was provided to the state of Israel in the wake of 67 offered an impression of lasting, that the foothold was tremendous and secured the future of the Jewish state even more than 47 and 48. Any other reasons that we think about 67? Yeah.
The relationship of the U.S. to Israel changed dramatically at the time that Israel felt much more independent of the United States at the same time as they also felt that the United States had to look have more balanced view of Israel in the Middle East situation.
Good. And we'll see that the questions of diplomacy and relationship between Israel and its neighbors and even distant neighbors was challenged in this moment. That's very important. And one is even more basic than these two very insightful comments. There's absolutely no question that the image of the Western Wall and having a completed domain over Jerusalem, Yerushalayim, Eretz Kodesh, was an incredible statement and feeling. And of course, just how the war went about. In contradistinction to maybe 73, when some of this was depleted to a certain extent, to a large extent, we should say, 67 in the effort, Sharon becomes a warrior. Comes, we talked to Rabbi Eisenberg endowed me with a certain messianic second coming, and I don't deserve that at all, but truth is that the heroes of 67 were celebrated as harbingers of a messianic rising. I think those all three, or now four points, are very important. Any others to add? Those were all the ones that I was thinking of. Yes?
Well, I was in New York at the time.
You were with Rabbi Rosenbaum?
No, not quite.
Okay.
My wife is related to him.
Okay.
I think this was the first time we had become used to the existence of the State of Israel, because we were too young in 1948, and we've seen we had seen the development of the country, and this was the first time in my lifetime that the existence of the State of Israel was actually threatened. And I think that was pervasive among
them. Certainly 47, 48 were very important moments, but there was a sense that this could be another, and we'll see in some of the sources, another Holocaust, and was a Holocaust averted in a way that this was, we'll see, it's an after Auschwitz mentality that's invoked. It's actually an important book that's published at this time. Yes.
Rabbi Allen coming on to the idea that 47, 48, people came ashore and weapons were placed in their hands before they had any training to use it. And it was simply a war of survival vis-a-vis 1967. Now we have an organized army and we're not going to be the
There's no question that in 67, Israel looks more like a nation than a band of brothers to a certain extent. Absolutely. Now, all of these factors, all of these forces on the political and cultural atmosphere, the religious atmosphere of Israel, meant that was something what Sidon Dubnow talked about, wrote about for the 18th and 19th centuries. You had the shifting centers of world Jewry. Whereas it was very, very clear, perhaps as early as the dawn of the 20th century, that America, that the United States, would be the Mecca, would be the center of Jewish life in 1967, because of all of these variables, it became all too clear to religious Zionists that the center was now shifting over the Atlantic, and perhaps rightfully, not perhaps rightfully, to Israel. Is that clear? It was very clear that world, that there was, if there was such thing as world Jewry, its capital, even if not recognized by the United Nations and the United States, the capital of world Jewry was quickly becoming Jerusalem, because after all, now we had Jerusalem. And so for the religious Zionist mind, something needed to change. Because while Aliyah was always one of several end goals for the Zionist mission, Chaim Weizmann, Louis Brandeis, Ahad Ha'am, had, who all these people read, of course, always spoke about multiple centers, always spoke about two great towers, one in Tel Aviv, one in Yafo, whatever. Certainly didn't even dawn on them it could ever be Yerushalayim, but one in Israel, and one in the United States. Rabbi Rosenbaum would have it in New York. Some people would have it in Chicago. But essentially, two major centers, one in Israel and one in the United States. And with 67, with the maturity of the State of Israel and the miraculousness of the Six-Day War, it became apparent that that paradigm needed to shift. It needed to, because it became clear, as several people remarked, that not just an end goal, but the primary end goal had to be Aliyah. It's interesting. I don't know if we have the data for it, but I'd actually like to know how many campers who attended Moshava Moshava started out in Indiana here in 42, 43? I'm not too far off, Mr. Matenki. What is it?
39.
Okay. 1939. It would be interesting to know how many of alumni, so to speak, of Moshava from 39 till 67 made Aliyah, and how many from the 60s and 70s made Aliyah. I have a hypothesis that that second generation ventured on Aliyah more frequently because it became a much more clearer pathway for the religious Zionist mission. But for those people dedicated to staying in the United States, there was a question of how to interpret religious Zionism in the wake of the Six-Day War. And so what I want to explore for the bulk of this evening is some of those reactions and interpret, based on these primary sources, how are people, because they're grappling, they're struggling with their religious Zionist identity in the wake of something miraculous, something quite good. It's a happy predicament, of course, but it's a predicament nevertheless. So source two, Sabbath Voice, which still exists today, is a comment from that it offers in June 23rd, 1967. It was the first time the Sabbath Voice, I presume this was printed also 2 weeks in advance, they didn't remark on the Six-Day War until the 23rd. This is a time of unparalleled sacrifice, right? The editors of Mizrahi in Chicago. The heroes of Israel are ready to give their lives to guarantee the independence of Israel and safeguard its great institutions of learning. This is the critical section. American Jewry, members of Mizrahi, must take care of our religious settlements, our cultural institutions. We must make sure that when our heroes come home from the battlefront and bring victory to Israel, they will once again be able to resume their studies and observance of the Torah. I was piqued, I was surprised that this was the comment, the first comment, the only comment, offered in the official publication of Chicago's Mizrahi on the Six-Day War. Anybody else surprised? What's in it? If we read those sentences critically, not negatively, but critically, what might we understand about this comment? What is the mission of Chicago Jewry, of American Jewry, in the aftermath of the Six-Day War, according to this Mizrahi editorial?
Seems to be a financial funding model. Instead of funding Israeli institutions that are aligned with Mizrahi values.
There is absolutely a financial component that is our role is to be the gvirim, to be the financial benefactors who support the Zionist engine. That seems to be an admission of a rather secondary role. That when our heroes return, they should be able to study Torah. The cultural stability is invoked here. I might be reading a little too much into it, but not too much, I think. That there is already a sense of the action is happening overseas. Our role is to bankroll, to help support the state of Israel. Anybody see something else, something different?
Was it the last three words mean observance of the Torah? As if while you're at the front, you can't observe the Torah?
No, to upkeep Torah, to make sure that their shuls have candles. Same things we say in Kumpur Khan. No. I don't read today. It's a good point. Anybody else? I saw some other hands. Yes.
I don't know, but maybe just that we shouldn't rest on our laurels and slacken off on religious observance since we won the war and we can take it as a...
It's there, right? It's always remarked as we must make sure that when our heroes, they are our heroes, but they're heroes who fought elsewhere. So my reading is that these people, the Iker Torah, the Iker Dat Torah, is happening elsewhere, I'm not saying it's unfortunate or fortunate, it's interesting to me. Yes.
I think the key words you're looking at are we American Jewry.
Which is very interesting, yes, I pointed out before. That we American Jewry,
there's a divide.
Yes, absolutely. I couldn't have said it better. Absolutely. There is a binary that's being constructed. That it's we American Jewry and they Israeli Jewry. And we is our heroes. There is a bond, but there's also simultaneously two components. Two very clear. Yes.
So he's saying that they're better? He's saying
he's not saying better, but for all I know, it's a she. The editor is offering a clear juxtaposition between the American Jewry and its responsibility and Israeli Jewry and the heroes that fought and need to come home to observe and to learn Torah.
There's no talk of Aliyah, there's no talk of joining them, there's no talk of...
Which is interesting, because it's... let's explore that. Yeah, I want to put that...
Who is the author?
Yes.
Because it's odd that Mizrahi, mm-hmm. in the official voice, would not have talked about the miracle and the euphoria.
It is. So I thought about that. I would only say that because of the late date of this publication, it's already the 23rd, perhaps they had already felt that much has been said about it. But maybe not. It is very interesting. I looked and I very often a historian anticipates what she or he is going to find in an archive. Sometimes you're right and sometimes you're not. I expected euphoria. And I found this, which is interesting.
I have to tell you that up until Yom Kippur of 73, that euphoria existed for 6 years.
No question. Absolutely no question. Nevertheless, there's a dimming of that in this source. But not in all of them. So I want to get to that. One of them, we know him as Rabbi Chaim Dov Keller. I have it right here. From the Sentinel in source 3, is none other than one of the two Rosh Yeshiva of?
Tells.
Of Tells. And what's always very interesting about Chicago, one cannot create, we talk about binaries, you cannot use that same anticipation in the prediction of saying, well, if this person's part of this community, he must be fall into these categories. He must be an anti-Zionist, a pro-Zionist. Things were bullocks in Chicago, and then happily so. And Rabbi Keller, who has, of course, a very interesting past, graduate of Yeshiva College. I believe somebody told me recently he was roommates of, his roommate was Rabbi Lamb, Rabbi Norman Lamb, wasn't it?
Judge Katz, Irwin
Katz. Was his roommate as well? Oh, okay.
And I believe he also has a law school education.
I believe so. I think that's correct, yes. Thank you, Mr. Bellis. In any case, Rabbi Keller offers the following. In June 29th, the euphoria is still very much in this. And like that, where is he getting it? So talking about the straits in Jordan. As we reflect in Source 3 on the God-wrought miracle, he calls it a miracle, which we have been privileged to see in the human miracle of this unprecedented unity of the Jewish people, we must not fail to realize that we are approaching the time of Mashiach. We cannot, we dare not, suffer the clock of spiritual attainment to be turned back. We cannot revert to the intolerable situation under which Jews were at odds with Jews, under which Jews felt that the nations of the world were our saviors. Playing off of his other Mashiach sentence. We are no longer after Auschwitz. We are now living after, what's that word? What is significant about that location?
Sinai.
Sinai, and what precipitated the Six-Day War was NASA threatening to close. Exactly right. Exactly. That's what he's referring to. We cannot turn back. We cannot turn the clock back, writes Rabbi Keller. We cannot regress to the time when there were secular Jews. For the Rosh Hashiva tells, what is the meaning? What is the miraculousness? The Nisim v'Niflaot of the Six-Day War. This turn back the clock business.
Where everybody recognizes God's hand in the miracle.
Nobody! We've witnessed miracles! No one can deny it! We've witnessed the Six-Day War. I think today is the anniversary of the 1985 Bears. Nobody can deny the hand of Ditka. Nobody can deny Lahavdil Elav Abdalos, the hand of God in 1967. You can't be a secular Jew any longer. One has to embrace that there are the pangs of the Messiah. That God, in the wake after Auschwitz, invoking that line, a title of a very important book that came out just 2 years prior, in the wake of the Holocaust, of the Nazis, Yimach Shemam V'Zichron, that God had given us Israel in 48 and 1967, had performed open miracles. There can no longer be secular Jews. You cannot turn back the clock. Interesting, I think that the writers of the hit musical Hairspray borrowed from Rabbi Keller in one of their songs.
You'd love to know that.
Yeah, you would. I would like to know that that were true. Yes?
Same law you'll be that, so. You know, I was saying we cannot return to the time we know that secular Jews. There are books written about the brilliant strategy and the preemptive offensive and airstrikes. And, like,
our task tonight is not to inquire into the theology of Rabbi Chaim Dovkel, although that is a terrific. One has to dig up the Jewish observers from the HDC library to do a full undertaking of that research. But leaving that aside, his reaction is what I'm really impressed by. In his interpretation, his immediate, within a few weeks of the Six-Day War, it is the end of secular Judaism. To him, I don't think he would agree any longer, but to him, what 1967 meant was, yes, Yemos HaMashiach, and yes, the end of secular Judaism. That everybody has to be, have a modicum, some semblance of a religious spirit. They had to imbibe something, because you couldn't deny it. You couldn't deny it.
Well, it's also interesting that he says, when he talks about saint, he's also not saying, right, Shabbos, he's saying, then, you know, what does it mean to that? You just said, to know that God exists. You know, I think it's a very revealing insight.
And true, to him, to acknowledge God's existence is to deny fidelity with, it's a good point, to deny fidelity with secularism. Other people's interpretations of what secularism mean might differ, but again, I'm only interpreting in his language. Moving on. A very important figure, understudied is Rabbi Moses Meshuloff, writes in The Voice. Anybody know what The Voice is? It's on the Sabbath Voice. No, nobody was a member of KINS in 1967. That was their monthly bulletin. It's amazing. It's amazing what kind archivists. I have to thank Kathy Block. It's on the record. So we have Kathy Block at Spertus. It's always good to be friends with archivists. They're very helpful people. Offers the following in December 67. What of this year's Six-Day War in the Mideast? Have to offer a comment. This is, you can imagine, the bulk of his editorials about Hanukkah. There is the loss of lives, the capture of equipment, the expansion of borders. At the same time, there emerges the rearmament of enemies. Remember, this is already 6 months later. Much of the mystique has left, although the euphoria remained for 6 years, the mystique was starting to wane. The hardening of new battle lines, infiltrators, new acts of violence, the criticism of many nations, and a very important point, the many nations. What must remain the symbol of this war's game? The Western Wall. Icons are very important. Symbols are very important for the human memory to maintain those footholds. The wall, this wall, reminder of Israel's underlying faith, is the foundation for renewal, belief in God, the Lord of hosts, our Father and King, flowery, which he did, Israel's shield and buckler. The Western Wall is a prayer wall to which hundreds of thousands of Jews have streamed. New faith in God, new loyalty to our people, new love for our ancestral land are the gains of the Six-Day War. He embraces sort of an Aliyah picture, talks about the greatest synagogue of all synagogues, is the Western Wall. Embraces the place, we haven't seen that quite yet, the place, the location of Israel, which is very interesting. He wrote another editorial. This one is actually a sermon he delivered, in all likelihood, at KINS. It was published in 1968. Don't know exactly when it was delivered, but what you can imagine sometime in 67, 68, centuries of heartbreaking exile, millennia of world persecution, I'm in source 5, and denigration failed to dim the prophetic hope. The gleaming but illusory offer of domicile by Italy and Spain, now he's talking about the long history, medieval history of the Jewish people, Germany and Russia ended in expulsions, no promise of a home in Uganda or even of a capital city, Tel Aviv, on Israel's soil, satisfied Israel's dream. Every nation on earth voted against Israel's possession of Jerusalem. Jerusalem the new was declared out of bounds to foreign embassies. Jerusalem the old was declared the city of Arabs rather than of Jews, even at the expense of the Christian right. Of Christian rights, excuse me. Mighty world powers fulminated against the tiny state of Israel. The United Nations passed resolutions against it. Yet Jerusalem is once more a united city. It is the capital of Israel. It is, and forever will remain, the, it's not a typo, the Jewish city. So in these two sermons, one of Chicago's leading rabbis has reminded us that the place, the image, is still important to American Jewry. There is greatness in imagining the Western Wall in Jewish hands. That too is important. Sometimes that comes at expense. So here is, she probably goes by another name now, she was a senior at Ida Crown in 1968. I tell you to be careful when you're writing, even when you're writing your columns in your high school yearbook, because people like me might find them. Annette Kaufman, The Wall. very interesting relationship she had to the wall. Very clearly, this young woman, she's not here, is she? This young woman visits Israel in the wake of 67, and she visits, and she doesn't gain that relationship. It's important that even though you have Rabbi Meshulam, you have an indication that the wall represents something, and it's always there. The fact that Israel is always there becomes a marching point, a symbol, an idea for America's Jews, that Israel can always be there. I can get there. It is a plane ride away. For some, that comes with a great level of confidence. For others, they go to Israel, like Ms. Kaufman, and she didn't, and she felt so strongly. She had so much anxiety, uninhibited by whatever she had anticipated of the Great Western Wall, that she had to write about it in her high school yearbook. Source 7. Or actually, before we do that, my last source, something I just found today. Just today. Should be a P there. I don't know how that got missed in the scan. Principal's Message. Rabbi Shlomo Rappaport, one of the great educators in Chicago Jewish history. He actually was honored by both the Religious Zionists of Chicago and the CRC simultaneously in June 1967. I worked really, really hard this morning to try to obtain that lecture. I'm sure that speech must have been preserved in some way. It's discussed in very effusive terms as a wonderful speech in the Rabbinical Council record. There's no question that it was a great speech. I'm very happy to disseminate it should it come. I worked really hard. Unfortunately, sometimes things don't come in time. But he does give you a sense in his annual message to the high school seniors in the Academy Memoirs in 1968. On behalf of the administration and teaching staffs, it's actually particularly poignant given current events. Teaching staffs of the Ida Crown Jewish Academy of Chicago and its Girls High School Division. It's no longer called that anymore. What's it called?
Hannah Sachs.
Exactly right. It's hard to believe. We congratulate you, the members of the graduating class of 1968, upon the formal culmination. Okay, this is perfunctory language. Next paragraph. It is perhaps coincidental yet rather significant that this year of your graduation is characterized by the 20th anniversary celebration of the State of Israel. Your commencement comes 2 decades after the establishment of Medinat Israel. In this glorious year of Israel, which followed the Six-Day War and reunification of Jerusalem. The next paragraph is really what I'm looking for. Your senior year was also unique in that you witnessed the completion of the construction program for the new home of the Ida Crown Jewish Academy and the Associated Talmud Torah Center at Pratt in Chicago. Chicago, California, as well as the relocation for the girls' high school to a more permanent facility. The new building of the academy will become a center of Torah learning. It really was. A center of Torah learning and religious training for the traditional Jewish youth of our community. Interesting. I'm very interested to see what Rabbi Matanky writes in this school's yearbook about what the symbolism of the move is. And the two lessons in the final paragraph, in this penultimate paragraph, there are the two lessons you have learned. These are the two lessons you have learned during the past 4 years in high school. The supremacy of Torah and the ideal of Zion. Combining the two. You leave the portals of our modern Beth Hamed, Beis Medrash, strengthened in the faith that the seal of the Lord is the Torah of truth. And that Israel, rebuilt and redeemed as the third commonwealth, represents the manifestation of God in Jewish history. No shock that Ms. Kaufman back in Source 6 was so dumbfounded that she couldn't appreciate what she had anticipated out of the Kotel. When you had a principal who understood that you had two centers, he was still clinging on to a previous vision. And perhaps he had to. The Pratt building was being established. It's kind of an odd thing. If you're a religious Zionist and that much, we have the shifting center to Israel, and nevertheless, the great building on Pratt in California has now risen, and now one has to justify what is the purpose. What is the purpose of this great building that would last for so many decades when we're trying to shift our focus to Tzion, to Zion? And so he perforce, as an occupant professionally, he has to, but I believe it's probably an ideal of his, that combining Torah and Zionism together, not his alchemy, of course, long before him, is this notion that we can be doing our Torah here and still be good devotees of Torah and Zionism, even while appreciating what's going on over there. It's interesting. It's interesting what he writes and how he understands both the Six-Day War and the new building. One final source. This will close. Source 7. Dr. Eliezer Berkovitz, very important philosopher, halachist, and a great educator. We have documents celebrating how devoted Rabbi Berkovitz was to his students in the classroom. It's always good to see that somebody could be a great scholar and a great teacher simultaneously. It doesn't usually happen. Usually one has to choose one or the other. Dr. Berkovitz, in 1970, he embarked on a project to understand the theology of the Holocaust. It was much in vogue among scholars at the time. Rabbi Soloveitchik, to a certain extent, had done it in 1956. Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, that is, and Kol Dovid Yofik. Rabbi Yitz Greenberg was engaging in this enterprise. Many, many scholars, many Jewish philosophers in universities were trying to grapple what is the meaning of the Holocaust, what is the meaning of the relationship between Judaism and Christianity in the post-Vatican II, post-Holocaust. All these were tied together. And Eliezer Berkovitz was the most orthodox Jewish spokesman in this very, very interesting debate. And while he's writing this book, which he writes the introduction, he began in the early 1960s. I think it was 1960. It took a long time to write, and he had to revise everything. He had to revise everything because all he thought about theology in the wake of the Holocaust was transformed, was replaced by his experience in observing 1967. So he has a chapter at the end when he explains how the Six-Day War really embosses his understanding of Holocaust theology. Without return to Zion, he writes as follows. Judaism and Jewish history become meaningless. The return is the counterpart in history to the resolution and faith that this world is to be established as the kingdom of God. Interesting prose. The thought has its roots in the very foundation of Judaism, but might have been mere wishful thinking had it not been supported by the reality of Israel. Its existence, its survival, its return to Zion. One must appreciate the irrationality of it all before one can grasp its significance. What's that mean, the irrationality of it all before one can grasp its significance? What Dr. Berkovitz suggested. It's a very strange formulation. The irrationality of it all. He's talking about history. Nothing irrational about history. Excuse me?
It's totally irrational.
History is.
Yes.
History as it unfolds is, or history as one conceives, what does that mean?
As it unfolds, I believe.
He's totally unpredictable.
Unpredictable.
Isn't he talking about the state of Israel and the irrationality?
The survival of the state of Israel.
The survival of the state? Let's unpack it.
Anti-Semitism is irrational.
Okay. Let's unpack it a little more. Let's read further. Before we can grasp its significance. In terms of exclusively man-made history, interesting man-made history, Israel's existence is irregular. Again, irrationality, irregular. a people like that of the Jews is not supposed to exist. It's survival, anomalous. A people as irregular as the Jews is not expected to survive. It's return to Zion, absurd. The irregular and anomalous compounded into the impossible realization of a delusion. For Israel, history is messianism on the way to kingdom, to the kingdom of God on earth. Because of that, Israel knows Auschwitz. Because of that, Israel, all through its history, has been on the way to Zion. I can never write this. I lose my historical credentials. Why? If I were to submit this to peer review, if I were to interpret the Six-Day War on these terms, I can never get away with it. A philosopher can. What's he saying about, I'll use that term again that I used at the very beginning, the enterprise of writing history. What is he suggesting? What is the philosophy? He's a philosopher. What is his philosophy of history? What should it be and what isn't?
All guided by God.
It has to be all guided by God. Because if I were a betting man, implies Dr. Berkovitz, I could never ever bet on the Jewish people. It's a lousy bet. You'd lose. You'd lose almost every time in a million. And nevertheless, the Jews do not. And if one were to be a professional historian and come up with grand theory for how the Jews survive, it's foolish. It's absolutely irregular. You can't offer theory. You can't be a political, a military historian, a cultural historian, a social historian, and understand Jewish history in light of the miracles because it's incomprehensible, infathomable. For Dr. Berkovitz, the Six-Day War was belief in and of itself. The Six-Day War, 48. 45, the Holocaust, 38 and 39, going back eons, 2,000 years. It is for him the foundation of his belief. And so the Six-Day War, maybe more than any other event for his sense of religious Zionism, was confirmation in belief itself. It had nothing to do with Aliyah. Well, he did make Aliyah, of course, at the end of his life. It had nothing to do with the politics of where the trajectory of religious Zionism. It had everything to do for Eliezer Berkovitz in why I believe in this religion and this God. And that's very powerful. I saw a couple of hands. Yeah.
What does he say that because of that Israel goes out? I didn't understand.
Reading through the book, it's dark, so it's unfair. I gave you, it's a 400 page book, and I gave you two paragraphs and excerpts from those two paragraphs. For him, the Holocaust is incomprehensible in light of Machshava, unless you have a happy ending. For him, the Six-Day War was that happy ending, to understand the temper and the relationship between God and man. It's a good question, something to talk about another time. Anything else? Dr. Berkovitz's language is very, very powerful. It's a very important book. It's gone through several printings. Yes.
Just a general question. I'm missing how Rabbi Rosenbaum is your fall guy because I missed what general thesis.
Oh, just that. Okay, so good. So a call to summarize and to conclude. I always got to know when to finish. Rabbi Rosenbaum, in this paragraph, I think he had a very high regard for Chicago's Jews, particularly Orthodox Jews. What I began is that Chicago's Jewish community thought very deeply about its contribution and aura of Zionism. And because of that, because Chicago's Jews took that mission with great consideration, it is a wonderful crucible to study how religious Zionism moved in the wake of the great celebrations of the Six-Day War. Because it was a great time, because there was a shifting center, because the United States and its relationship to Israel could not, its relationship could not remain stagnant, needed to change. And for Jews in Chicago, of all stripes, people who on this source sheet would not daven with one another, nevertheless thought very, very deeply about their Zionism and came up with new interpretations, with reinterpretations of how to move forward as responsible religious Zionists. They offered many different cues. They offered many different pathways moving forward for the religious Zionist experience in the United States. And I'll bet that simultaneously some of each resonate with the people in this room, but I'd also guess that not a single one captures your individual emotion. And it's a complicated relationship between religious Zionists in America and the state of Israel. It was always very complicated. Always. 1967 complicated the matter. What's so interesting and in some ways inspiring is that in this community, in Lishkan was about to move at this time, so it might have been here, that the discussions
in Foster,
so it would have come here, good, yeah, to be corrected, that, but in general, the Chicago, good to know, the Chicago Jewish community was always thinking very hard about religious Zionism and always thinking in a way that it could move forward. And our challenge, and there are considerable challenges today of how we understand our own personal religious Zionism, it's comforting to know that very serious women and men took that charge some 40 years ago and offered a vision that we can accept, or we too can interpret in our own time moving forward for generation upon generations yet to come. Thank you very much.
I didn't show this.
More questions?
Great. I think we have time for one or two questions if anyone has that hasn't had a chance yet.
I just want to say I remember this vividly. I grew up in South Shore, south side of Chicago, and there's a paragraph in one of the editorials about passing the push keys around, and that's what we did for the effort. Instead of Hebrew school, we went in the neighborhood, and everybody was very supportive, mostly Gentiles. I remember Irish women saying how they support Israel, and here, and we collected, basically every house. Everybody was, very...
So I'm glad it resonates.
It was an amazing experience.
So one source that I didn't put on the source, I neglected, is an issue of Kolenu from the high school, from the, it was called just then, I think, the Yeshiva High School. It wasn't called the Fastman Yeshiva High School. The senior class of Yeshiva High School. And there's an editorial from December 1967. Rabbi Allen Eisenberg, and not yet Rabbi Eliyahu Soloveitchik are on the editorial board. And it's quite interesting. And it even struck 17 and 18-year-olds the importance of the moment. And in the first editorial, the importance of being Moser Nefesh for Torah and for Zionism was very much taken up as the mantra for the young boys at the Skokie Shiva. Yeah.
I would like to say that the reality is any of us that lived through that period, whether in the Yeshiva or the Academy, saw it directly. I know that the Yeshiva and Bnei Akiva raised enough money in a few days before the war. By the time the war started, the Rebbein stopped up. But in a few days before the war, they raised enough so that three ambulances were sent to Israel.
So that's great to know. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Rabbi Elif. A wonderful lecture again. We thank everyone for coming.